Escucha el podcast de Negras. Este programa se emite los viernes a las 3 de la tarde por Radio Universidad de Puerto Rico en el 89.7 FM San Juan y el 88.3 FM Mayagüez. Todo un mundo de música e información.
Cadena Radio Universidad de Puerto Rico presenta Negras, producido por Colectivo ILE, un espacio para visibilizar proyectos antirracistas y educar de forma crítica e informada sobre la negritud y la racialización.
Negras me enseña a nombrar.
Hoy en Negras les saluda Bárbara Abadía Rezach. Para conversar sobre inequidad social, negritudes y diásporas, me acompaña la antropóloga jamaiquina Doreen Gordon. Doreen posee un bachillerato en sociología de University of West Indies, Mona, una maestría en ciencias sociales de University of Chicago y otra en antropología de London School of Economics and Political Science. Al finalizar su doctorado en antropología en the University of Manchester, completó un postdoctorado en University of Pretoria, Sudáfrica. Desde 2010, se desempeña como profesora e investigadora en the University of the West Indies, Mona, en su natal Jamaica. Es la autora del libro Blackness and Social Mobility in Brazil, Contemporary Transformations, publicado en 2022. Long time no see you, Doreen. We have met more than a decade ago in an academic conference in San Diego, California. So yeah. Having you in Negras is a pleasure. Welcome to Negras. How are you doing?
Thank you so much, and thank you for inviting me to speak with you on this program.
It is a pleasure to have. I think you are the first Jamaican person that we interview here in Negras. So finally, we have somebody from Jamaica, and it's you. We always start this program asking people how they identify themselves, how they think about racialization processes. How do you identify yourself racially? ¿Cómo te identificas racialmente, Doreen?
Well, I identify as a Black person, even as I recognize that, you know, I'm lighter skinned. And, you know, in Jamaica anyway, that places me in a more privileged position. And even in other countries, when I've lived in Brazil, for example, people were very disappointed that I was a Jamaican who did not look dark skinned with dreadlocks, you know, and they were wondering as to my authenticity. Was I an authentic Jamaican, right? So, I mean, in countries like Jamaica and Brazil, I know I'm more likely to be labeled mixed race, brown, or even white in some settings. Mm-hmm. So I recognize and acknowledge that I don't have the same racialized experiences as maybe darker skinned, poorer Jamaicans. But at the same time, it's my particular journey, my personal experience that has led me to identify as Black. And it's not something new. I identified as Black from way back in high school, you know, and my high school classmates will recall, you know, them asking me what is my racial identity. And I replied that I see myself as Black.
So Doreen nos cuenta que se identifica como una persona jamaiquina negra, a pesar de que reconoce su privilegio por tener la piel un poco más clara, que en Brasil, en la propia Jamaica, pues ha sentido un poco el cuestionamiento de las personas por cómo luce físicamente, fenotípicamente, pero desde escuela superior, cuando le hacían la pregunta de cómo se identificaba, pues responde que es una persona negra reconociendo sus privilegios. También es interesante que Doreen menciona que la gente esperaría que ella fuese una persona de piel oscura con dreadlocks, porque es el estereotipo que se tiene de las personas de Jamaica. ¿Alguna memoria que puedas relacionar con este proceso de internalizar que eres una persona racializada como no blanca? Doreen, do you have any memories that you can relate to your process of internalizing that you are not a non-white racialized person?
Well, three important experiences influenced my racial identity. I would say my schooling, my political, intellectual environment, and time that I spent living in other countries outside of the Caribbean. So firstly, I went to school in largely working class areas where the majority of my classmates were darker skinned and from lower socioeconomic status as well. I attended the Hope Valley Experimental Primary School in Jamaica, which is located in the neighborhood of Augustown, which is a working class community, but at the same time, it is close to the university and it benefits from the university's patronage. So, I mean, it is one of the better primary schools, but the students largely came from the surrounding community. So I was surrounded by Black people. And I grew up in this way. I was teased about my skin color, but I also learned traits and behaviors that helped me to adapt and probably made me a good social scientist, more humble, understanding of what it is like to step into somebody else's shoes. And secondly, my family, especially my father and his friends, were politically involved at the time. In a communist party, and they were sort of, leading this revolution to make Jamaica a better place, to make Jamaica a more just society. And that was one of the reasons why they chose the schools that they did for their children. They wanted to turn around the whole structure of privilege in Jamaica. And so I grew up amongst Black conscious intellectuals, activists, community activists fighting for social justice, and identified with those kinds of movements, as well as, cultural movements that were taking place at the time. I was very involved in dance, for example, Afro-Caribbean dance. And then finally, I lived in other countries where I was definitely not white, visiting or living in countries like Denmark, where I went on an intercultural exchange program to Denmark. And then I studied in the United States and in the United Kingdom and lived in Brazil and South Africa. So in all of these different contexts, I was aware of being a racialized other, definitely other, not white. And I also had experiences of being exposed to racism. For example, when I was living in the United Kingdom as, attending school and so on, I was a teenager. And I was aware, for example, of teachers placing me with particular groups of students, like other foreigners, and there was one time when they tried to place me in a lower grade, and my father came to the school and he argued for my case. There were definitely incidences where I had experiences of racial discrimination.
So Dori nos cuenta que sí ha experimentado discriminación racial, pero además creció y estudió alrededor de la clase trabajadora, rodeada de gente negra en su escuela elemental. También nos cuenta que a través de su padre estuvo expuesta al activismo sociopolítico antirracista en Jamaica. También pues se involucró en bailes afrocaribeños. Y además nos dice que sus experiencias en Dinamarca, Estados Unidos, el Reino Unido, en Inglaterra, Suráfrica, Jamaica, pues la han colocado en posiciones en las que sí ha sufrido la discriminación racial como persona no blanca. ¿Cómo se manifiesta el racismo antinegro en Jamaica? ¿Cómo se percibe? How is racism against blacks manifested in Jamaica and how it is perceived?
I think many people think racism doesn't exist in Jamaica because it's understood to be a black country, a majority black country. But racism is expressed, particularly in how people talk about physical appearance. And this you might be familiar with as well, Barbara. The discourses and practices having to do with the shade of your skin, the texture of your hair, the shape of certain physical features like your nose or your mouth. I mean, in Jamaica, one of the things that you do when a baby is born is to visit and see what the baby's features look like, what the skin color of the baby is and the hair texture and so on. And granted, these kinds of things can be or are intertwined with other kinds of inequalities like class and race and so on. So sometimes it is not as obvious, or in your face. And it's complicated sometimes because in Jamaica, we have the practice of skin bleaching amongst both women and men, right? And there's a big debate as to why it exists. Obviously, there are issues of race involved, but also why do people bleach? Is it for economic reasons or the desire for social mobility or popularity or visibility? You know, so there is a debate as to why bleaching is a phenomenon in Jamaica. But the truth is, it's really right across class, not just lower class Black Jamaicans, but you also see it amongst the middle class as well. The belief that being lighter skinned will afford you greater opportunities. And, you know, there are certain things in Jamaica that you see and you know, is racism, but sometimes people don't necessarily see it that way. For example, violence and against poor Black communities, which exists right across the Black diaspora. But people don't see it as racism necessarily in Jamaica. But then, you know, the police, the army, the state, and so on don't really treat middle class or upper class communities in the same way. You will never see police or the army entering those communities to harass or arrest or violently treat the residents. But poor Black communities bear the brunt of violence and this fight against crime in Jamaica. And that, I think, is an incidence of racism. And another area is simply being racist against a set of people because they are poor or they practice an African or type of religion. In Jamaica, we have Afro-Caribbean religions like Obia or Pocomania, Revival, that are more associated with African practices. And we can see prejudice towards those groups in the society. But also one of the big things that I was surprised at recently is that our prime minister came out expressing support for Haiti and saying that we have got to help Haiti, you know, deal with some of the problems that the country is facing. Yet 37 refugees arrived from Haiti on Jamaica's shore recently on a boat, 37 people who are fleeing war, are fleeing hunger, are fleeing violence. And they were collected by the police and recently charged by the Jamaican court, actually fined, and will be deported to Haiti. And to me, that is racism. It's racism against a poor Black country. And Jamaicans also believe that Haitians practice voodoo, which they associate with being an evil religion, unchristian religion. And so for many people, Haitians fall on this kind of continuum where they are closer to Africa, closer to being uncivilized, closer to being, you know, uneducated, Black, and so on. And so I think this reveals our racism.
Wow, Doreen nos acaba de decir, ¿verdad?, en una forma general, pero muy impactante, cómo se manifiesta el racismo antinegro en Jamaica y cómo se percibe. A pesar de que parecería de que no hay racismo antinegro en Jamaica, porque es un país mayoritariamente negro, sí existe. Por ejemplo, cuando nace un bebé, se va a visitar para ver cómo son sus características físicas y fenotípicas. Hay una práctica de blanqueamiento de la piel. Y Doreen nos cuenta que hay un debate de por qué la gente se blanquea la piel, si es por razones económicas, simplemente por apariencia, pero sin duda el querer verse con la piel más clara pues tiene que ver con procesos también de racialización, de discriminación y prejuicio. La raza y la clase están completamente vinculadas en el escenario jamaiquino. Parecería no tan obvio, obviamente, porque pues parece que no existe racismo entre las personas negras de Jamaica. Hay violencia contra las personas empobrecidas y criminalización por parte de la policía, así que es algo muy parecido a lo que ocurre en Puerto Rico. It's very similar to what happened in Puerto Rico, the criminalization against poor Black people in Puerto Rico. In Puerto Rico, poverty has the face of a Black woman or Black men in our country. Hay prejuicio contra religiones y prácticas espirituales afrocaribeñas, y nos cuenta que recientemente llegó un grupo de haitianos refugiados a Jamaica y las leyes jamaiquinas han decidido deportar a estas personas porque hay un racismo en contra de las personas haitianas, principalmente porque dicen que por el tipo de religión que practican o las espiritualidades como el vudú que practican las personas haitianas. Así que ella nos cuenta que este es otro ejemplo de cómo se manifiesta el racismo antinegro en Jamaica. Thank you for giving us this panorama of how mm-hmm. anti-Black racism operates in Jamaica, and the relationship with Haiti as well is something that is very similar here in Puerto Rico. You have been lived in Jamaica, the United States, you mentioned Denmark, England, South Africa, Brazil, and you're a very young person, Dorin. What do you highlight about racial inequality in each of these geographic spaces, similarities or differences? Le pregunto a Dorin, ¿qué puede destacar sobre la inequidad racial en todos esos países y lugares donde ha vivido?
I think that in Jamaica, Brazil, and South Africa, there is this kind of brown or mixed race identity that stands a little bit apart from being darker skinned or black. So, you know, racial identity in Jamaica and Brazil tends to be more fluid, or I found it to be more fluid than it was in South Africa or the United States or the United Kingdom. You know, people can maneuver along this kind of black-white continuum in both Jamaica and Brazil, not just based on your physical appearance and skin color and so on, but also your cultural expression. So you could have a lighter-skinned person that identifies with African culture and traditions, or a dark-skinned person that identifies with British culture and traditions. So there is more flexibility. Being mixed race or brown in either Jamaica or Brazil was actually seen as something positive. So, you know, in Jamaica, we have the national motto, out of many, one people. And in Brazil, also this kind of focus on this mixed race identity, right? And so it was kind of seen as a positive thing. But in South Africa, it was quite different. It was being mixed race was a more ambiguous category, sometimes negative social category, because, you know, coming out of the apartheid system, people were put in sort of categories that were meant to represent pure racial types. And so mixed race people were neither white nor black. And also there were kind of legal prohibitions against mixed race unions. You know, so they weren't really seen as belonging to either group, and they were associated with negative traits like vulgarity, promiscuity, drunkenness, you know. And so that was one of the first places that I've lived where there was this kind of ambiguous and negative kind of connotation to being mixed race. In the United States and the United Kingdom, it didn't matter whether you are mixed race or black, you are definitely just other, you're not white, right? And like I said, I remember being put at a table where foreigners who were also not white sat in the classroom, you know? So in those cultures or those countries, I felt like, I guess once you are not white, you will experience some form of discrimination, you know, and of course, darker skinned people in the United Kingdom and the US probably are exposed to more, you know, more incidences of racism, but it still exists, you know. And I also, you know, remember, for example, the attitude of teachers or lecturers in school, and almost kind of like an assumption that you are less intelligent, coming from a poorer country, not white. You know, I felt those kinds of things in Europe and Europe as well, Denmark, the United Kingdom, and the US. Denmark was, at the time that I was an exchange student in Denmark, they were receiving a lot of migrants into the country from Asia and parts of Africa, who people who were, you know, seeking refuge in Europe. And there was a period of Denmark being liberal and allowing, you know, these communities into the country. But there was also backlash. And I remember at my school feeling that backlash among some students who felt that they wanted Denmark to remain homogenous, you know, as a white country. So, well, those are my experiences. I hope I covered it as best as I could.
Sí, por supuesto. You have been covered a lot. Dorin nos menciona cómo Brasil y Jamaica hay un poco más de fluidez y flexibilidad por la misma situación de la diversidad, de las mezclas raciales que hay, ¿verdad? Pero eso no implica que no haya racismo antinegro. También el hecho de las expresiones culturales también hace que estas experiencias sean un poco más fluidas y flexibles. En el caso de South Africa, nos señala que ser una persona mixta, ¿verdad?, o mezclada, podría ser algo negativo, porque se busca un poco esta idea de la raza pura, etcétera, ¿verdad?, por el apartheid, ¿verdad?, pero todo esto obviamente tiene un contexto político muy importante que no debemos, ¿verdad?, pasar desapercibido. En el caso de Inglaterra, Estados Unidos y Dinamarca, también tuvo experiencias de discriminación y prejuicio, y se piensa, bueno, si eres una persona negra, porque vienes de un país pobre y negro, como es el caso de Jamaica, así que en cada una de estas regiones, pues ha tenido experiencias muy particulares, pero todas dan cuenta de cómo se sobreviven, ¿verdad? Y cómo se manifiestan los procesos de racialización y cómo las personas vistas como no blancas pues sobreviven unas experiencias muy particulares. La experiencia de vivir en distintos lugares pues le ha permitido a Dorin hacer un trabajo de investigación antropológico comparativo. En el 2018, en el libro Beauty and the Norm, Debating Standardization of Bodily Appearance, publicó un capítulo que tituló Body Beautiful, Comparative Meanings of Beauty in South Africa, Brazil and Jamaica. Y le pregunto qué papel juega la negritud en la construcción de estereotipos de belleza que nos ha mencionado, ¿verdad? Como, por ejemplo, en el caso de Jamaica hay skin bleaching, ¿no? El blanqueamiento de la piel. ¿Y cómo se define la belleza en Sudáfrica, Brasil y Jamaica? I was telling the audience, Dorin, that the experience of living in different places has allowed you to do comparative anthropological research work. In 2018, in the book Beauty and the Norm, Debating Standardization of Bodily Appearance, you published a chapter entitled Body Beautiful, Comparative Meanings of Beauty in South Africa, Brazil, and Jamaica. What roles does blackness play in the construction of beauty stereotypes, and how is beauty defined in South Africa, Brazil, and Jamaica?
I think in those settings, all of them that I have lived and conducted some research, there is the sense of grappling with a history of colonialism and white supremacy, which have shaped, you know, the discourses and practices about race in all those places, in public life and in personal life. And that whiteness was and still is held up to be a standard of beauty, of morality, of education, of civilization. But it's changing, you know? And so this meant, you know, that there are certain stereotypes that I saw across all of those countries, stereotypes about, you know, where Africa was equated with something negative, with particularly with not being aesthetically appealing, you know, like the body features or black bodies being considered to be undesirable, you know, in the sense of certain bodily features, maybe too excessive, maybe out of proportion. Black bodies being uncontrolled. There was a sense in which these stereotypes or negative stereotypes existed, and people were negotiating them, pushing back against them, resisting them, or accommodating them to different levels. So in Brazil, for example, there is a plastic surgery called correction of the negroid nose, and it still exists, you know? So this idea of certain bodily features like the nose or having full lips or kinky curly hair still being associated with something negative, you know? And then in both Jamaica and Brazil, there's this history of having different terminologies for different skin shades and different physical features. So in Jamaica, for example, you had terms like mulatto, you had terms like sambo or octoroon, all of which referred to different skin shades. In Brazil, there are over 150 different racial terms used to describe people along a kind of racialized continuum. And all of the physical features matter, the hair, the shape of certain bodily features. Yet at the same time, they are contexts in which Brazilians might celebrate Blackness. In particular, that had to do with having a bunda or a boom boom, you know? In other words, a bottom, right? So if you have a nicely shaped round bottom, that was seen as a positive attribute. And it was seen to be an African trait that you could celebrate. Right. So it seemed like particular parts of the body that represented Blackness could be celebrated, but not others. And so in Brazil, while having a rounded bottom that apparently comes from Africa was a good thing, but having really kinky, curly hair, for example, is not a good thing, you know? So it's kind of complicated. And I would say in Brazil, there was more focus on plastic surgery than maybe Jamaica, because there is you can access plastic surgery through the public health system in Brazil at a subsidized rate. And so some people do that, as well as other people access it privately. But you can manipulate your physical appearance in different ways through plastic surgery in Brazil. In Jamaica, it is more associated with celebrities. So like singers, popular musicians and so on. For example, the dancehall artist Spice, you know, people were talking about her recently and the possibility that she underwent some plastic surgery in the Dominican Republic. And so, you know, people may talk about it in relation to celebrities, but not really ordinary people, you know? And in South Africa, the focus on dress, very important that, you know, Black people had to dress respectably in order to be, you know, enter into the new South Africa and enter into new social spaces that were opening up across the country to Black people. But there was this kind of sense in which there was work to be done on appearance. There was work to be done on clothing and self-presentation. And I felt that this was a big part, not just in contemporary South Africa, but I remember Mandela actually talking about it in the book Long Walk to Freedom, about his one professional suit when he was studying to be a lawyer, his one suit that he had to be washing and ironing and so on and wearing it every day to school. And that he was one day walking on the road and saw somebody that he knew on the other side of the road, and he was trying to avoid them so they couldn't see like his faded and, you know, old suit, you know. So there was this whole sense in which self-presentation and clothing was very important in terms of gaining access to certain social spaces in South Africa as a Black person.
Dorinos acaba de hablar sobre los ideales de belleza y los estereotipos de belleza y los estándares de belleza que tienen que ver con las personas negras. En el caso de Brasil, nos habla de la proliferación de cirugías plásticas para la nariz principalmente, como algunas partes del cuerpo se celebran, como por ejemplo las nalgas, el trasero, sin embargo el cabello, pues no, o la nariz o los labios. En el caso de Jamaica ya nos había hablado sobre el tema de la, del blanqueamiento, y nos dice que a través de las figuras públicas y celebridades, pues se ve un poco, ¿no?, cuando se hacen cirugías plásticas, algunas en República Dominicana, para cambiar algunos de esos rasgos fenotípicos que se asocian con negritud. En el caso de Sudáfrica, nos habla de que la belleza está bastante supeditada a la vestimenta, y nos mencionó el caso de Nelson Mandela, y cómo pues tenía que vestir bien, ¿verdad?, de cierta forma, para tener acceso a ciertos espacios. Así que así tenemos un poco, ¿no?, esta idea de cómo la belleza también influye en la construcción de las identidades negras. En breve regresamos con Negras y continuaremos dialogando con Doreen Gordon sobre inequidad social, negritudes y diásporas. Sigue en sintonía con Radio Universidad de Puerto Rico.
Está escuchando el podcast de Negras. Este programa se emite los viernes a las 3 de la tarde por Radio Universidad de Puerto Rico en el 89.7 FM San Juan y el 88.3 FM Mayagüez. Todo mundo de música e información.
Usted está escuchando Negras, inspiradas en las grandezas de nuestras ancestras. Le saluda Bárbara Abadía Resach. Hoy converso con la antropóloga jamaicana Doreen Gordon sobre inequidad social, negritudes y diásporas. A partir del trabajo académico de Doreen y sus vivencias personales, me interesa saber cómo define lo que es diáspora africana y si sigue siendo útil el concepto. Doreen, based on your academic work and your personal experiences living around the world, how do you define the African diaspora? Is this concept, diaspora, still useful?
I define it as transnational space, not necessarily defined by geography, in which there is some kind of mutual recognition of a solidary or common consciousness, despite our fragmented geographies. However, this consciousness is not always available, but it rises at particular times and places, you know, such as during specific political, social, or cultural movements. I'm thinking here of the struggle for civil rights of Black Americans in the 1960s, or Pan-Africanist organizing in the 1960s and 70s, or in Jamaica, the Black Conscious Movement, the spread of Rastafari religion, which emphasized a strong radical Black consciousness, or the Black Lives Matter movement that spread globally, not just from the United States, but to Europe and also Brazil. I mean, yes, there are differences across the Black diaspora in terms of language, in terms of our social and economic situation, in terms of even how people identify, you know. For example, how do you define somebody who is both African descendant and indigenous, you know? And those kinds of questions are being confronted right now by the Jamaican Maroons, you know, who were runaway communities of slaves under colonialism. And they define themselves both as indigenous and Black. And this is creating some debate and controversy in the country as to, you know, how they can be both identities. So that's something to look at. But nevertheless, African diaspora has become a fundamental way of conceptualizing the experience of African-descended communities. And, you know, while recognizing that it is complicated, you know, there are, you know, issues and conditions and experiences that affect Black people across different countries. You know, we are tied up within global circulation of ideas about race, about difference, within a kind of global ranking of cultures, you know, Blackness appears at the bottom of the hierarchy, Africanness, while white culture is still held to be inferior. And that affects the local hierarchies of Black population everywhere, you know, Black populations across the world negotiate similar conditions. You know, you were talking about violence and crime in Black communities in Puerto Rico. I witnessed that in South Africa. I see that in Jamaica. I see it in the United States, you know. The marginalization too, and maybe even demonization of Black men. It's something that is an issue in Jamaica. It's something that is an issue in other countries as well. Various strategies having to do with controlling or policing the Black body, including attitudes towards physical appearance. There's a huge debate taking place in universities and schools and workplaces in different contexts in South Africa, in the United Kingdom, in the United States, Jamaica, about hair and African textured hair in places such as the workplace or schools, you know. So there is this debate going on now across all these contexts about discrimination against hair in public settings, like school and the workplace. And increasingly we're seeing people filing legal cases of discrimination. And so it's not just in Jamaica, but in other places as well, that this debate has been happening. So I think that there are situations, conditions that affect Black people everywhere, and which give some significance to the term African diaspora, relevance to the term African diaspora.
In your book, Blackness and Social Mobility in Brazil, Contemporary Transformation, that was published in 2022, you talk about social mobility and contemporary transformation among Black peoples in Brazil. Así que en tu libro hablas también de la movilidad social y de las transformaciones contemporáneas de la gente negra en Brasil. Can you tell us about more about your book and your findings about Black people and social mobility and contemporary transformations?
Sure. Well, the book examines the emergence of a Black middle class in an urban city in Brazil, Salvador. Granted that Black middle class is small, but after three decades of Black mobilization in Brazil that has been taking place, and against the backdrop of, you know, dramatic economic, cultural, and political transformations, I wanted to see if there was something new or different, any kinds of transformations in the lives of Black people. And I mean, the topic of Black social mobility in Brazil is not new. I mean, there is things written about it, both in Portuguese and in English. And all of them talk about or recognize the role of racism in impeding Black social mobility in Brazil, but very much focused on the individual more than the individual in a family situation and how what sort of social context. The book also looks at, you know, all the more traditional methods of social mobility, because traditionally Black people in Brazil could strategize and use education or marriage or strategies in which they could associate with whiteness, such as education, gaining money or wealth. And so there were these kind of older methods of mobility, but there were also newer ones that were based more on positive valuation of Blackness and actual avenues of social mobility through cultural and heritage industries, for example, or niche markets that emphasized Afro-Brazilian culture and traditions like cuisine, you know, and other things, and as well as the expansion of, you know, industries like the service industry, transportation, the oil industry played a major role in opening up some avenues of social mobility for Black Brazilians in Salvador.
What is needed for this model to be replicated in other countries of the hemisphere? If we think about this example of Salvador Bahia, thinking about Jamaica or Puerto Rico or other countries mm-hmm. of the Caribbean, for example.
Well, I think Brazilian social and cultural movements, despite having limited resources and you know, their message kind of I think their message has filtered throughout the population more than we realize. And they have achieved a lot in terms of networking with other social movements in other countries. Social movements in Brazil, they have networked with those in other parts of Latin America, with the United States, with South Africa, to a lesser extent, the Caribbean. But the Caribbean is still a really important space of inspiration for Brazilian social activists who borrow from thinkers like Marcus Garvey, Walter Rodney, who is Guyanese, and other Caribbean thinkers. They see the Caribbean as a space of Black consciousness, and they borrow, certain ideas from it. But they are really good at networking across national and language barriers. And I think that's something that we can learn from them. You know, not allowing language to be a barrier and to create those avenues of partnership across different countries in the diaspora. I think also they paid particular importance to education. In the book, I talk about a non-governmental organization run by Black activists where they are paying particular attention to education and getting Black students into good programs in schools and so on. So there is quite an emphasis on not just education, but also public education initiatives about race and inequality, which I think could be replicated across the region. And I have to say, many of these organizations are working with limited funding, and they managed to achieve a lot in the area of arts, theater, music, media. They are highlighting issues of social inequality, Blackness, racism. And I think the message is filtering through, the rest of the population. I think also they are involved with disseminating national statistics, statistical data from census surveys, household surveys, and so on, and making it widely available and accessible to the citizens. And I think this is important, particularly in Jamaica, where statistical data tends to remain quite tightly within certain national bodies like the Planning Institute of Jamaica or STATIN. And these bodies, hold on to this kind of statistical data, and you have to ask for permission to, gain access to this information. And sometimes you have to pay. Whereas in Brazil, I think that this is quite something that has been achieved, that large statistical data has been disseminated and, analyzed in different ways and is made available to the public. I think that's important. So those three things, the importance of education, networking across national and language barriers, the role of the arts, theater, music, media, and then finally, disseminating national statistical data on inequality.
Ahora Dorin está investigando sobre cambio climático, así que le voy a preguntar sobre qué ha encontrado, porque para esta temporada de negras en que nos interesa saber sobre la diáspora, es importante conocer sobre qué investigaciones se están dando sobre temas tan importantes como este. Dorin, now you're researching water quality, scarcity, and floods in coastal and watershed communities in Jamaica. What preliminary findings can you share with us?
Okay, so this is part of my recent efforts to make my research more Caribbean focused, because before this it was Brazil or South Africa. So now I'm delving into Caribbean research. And this particular project, I'm working with an interdisciplinary team. So I'm not the only person, it's about five of us. And I'm working with scientists who are investigating things like water quality and other issues having to do with flooding and drought in coastal communities and watershed communities. My role in that project is to look at communities and how communities are being affected by climate change, how they are negotiating some of these changes, and how maybe communities can be helped to adjust to some of these climate issues, you know, that they are experiencing, which is really quite impacts on their livelihood. So I'm thinking in particular of reduced fish stock, rising temperatures in of ocean waters, less availability of groundwater sources as droughts and longer periods of droughts. Actually, what is happening is that the water table is getting lower, and it's being polluted by the seawater, because seawater is rising. So we will have problems with water security, with food security, and also health, you know, if, you know, our soils have more salt in them from the sea, then this has issues for our health. And so I really promote this kind of interdisciplinary approach, where, you know, each person works with their expertise. So it's really the scientists that are looking at water quality and other kinds of issues like flooding and disaster preparedness, whereas I'm looking more at the communities themselves and community well-being and, you know, other issues of resilience to climate change. One of the big issues is that traditional fishermen are actually losing their access to coastal land, not just because of climate change, but also because, you know, huge multi-million dollar construction projects, housing projects, hotel developments, are displacing them from their land. And so I think a huge issue is land reparations or land reform and how we're gonna deal with some of these issues, because they are impacting particularly poor and vulnerable communities that have long relied on coastal resources for survival.
Doreen nos cuenta que este nuevo enfoque en el Caribe, a través de su trabajo académico, es uno interdisciplinario, y el trabajo que hacen los científicos para investigar la calidad del agua, pues ella se enfoca más en las comunidades, en el bienestar de las comunidades, cómo están lidiando con estas situaciones de cambio climático, pero Adam también nos menciona cómo el desplazamiento es uno de los problemas que se están viendo en Jamaica, en las zonas costeras. Los pescadores están sufriendo el desplazamiento por las construcciones de hoteles, etc. Así que uno de los enfoques principales es no solamente el bienestar de las comunidades, pero también pensar las reparaciones, ¿verdad? Que merecen estas comunidades negras. Doreen, también has estado interesada en los efectos de la pandemia del COVID-19 en el Caribe. Y pregunto, ¿no? ¿Cómo ha sobrevivido la pandemia en Jamaica? You have been interested in the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic in the Caribbean. How have you survived the pandemic in Jamaica?
Okay, well, I recently finished writing an article along with some other colleagues on this issue. And the low uptake of the COVID-19 vaccine in Jamaica. I mean, Jamaica in particular has been highlighted for having low confidence and uptake of the COVID-19 vaccine. Other Caribbean countries may have been more successful, like Barbados, Cayman Islands, Guyana, but Jamaica's uptake has been extremely low, I think within the 20% region. And so there have been, you know, various studies to try and find out why this is the case. But I mean, certainly one of the ways, one of the things is that Jamaicans distrust the government, and that government distrust has been growing. It's not a new phenomenon, but it has been growing over time. And people just did not trust the medical information that was being put out by the Ministry of Health, despite that it was based on science and evidence, but it was not really coming across to the population in a way that was accessible, you know, to people. And so there have been high levels of distrust. And one of the ways in which Jamaicans have been surviving this pandemic is heavy reliance on traditional medicines, herbal medicines, plant medicines, you know, and eating, trying to eat healthy and build up the body's immune system. I think many Jamaicans have preferred to go that route as opposed to taking the vaccine, right? So that's one thing that, you know, how Jamaicans have been coping. But also quite alarmingly, there has been a huge dropout of children from schools during the pandemic. Obviously, many children didn't have access to the internet when schools went online. And it was a period of time in which children turned to work in order to help their families. And so what you find is that there's a high degree of working children. And the teachers and the Ministry of Education have reported that there has not been a 100% return of the children back to school. So the impact on education has been rough. And the school dropout rates have remained high even after in this post-pandemic period.
We are approaching the end of the International Decade for People of African Descent, 2015-2024. What stands out from this decade in terms of racial inequality for you, Doreen?
For me, I'm just going to say, well, the Black Lives Matter movement and its global impact is something that really stood out about this period of time and the you know, that period of the pandemic and so on. It's you know, caused some reflection across different countries in the Black diaspora. Although it has waned in recent years, I think it played a role in highlighting inequalities, in particular violence against Black communities. And I see increased awareness and agitation to confront issues of violence against the Black community amongst a wider group of people in the United States, you know, across race, across class, people kind of supporting the Black Lives Matter movement. I also see quite worryingly a backlash against movements towards racial equality and witness in the United States the recent decision to challenge affirmative action, you know, in universities. And this is, I think it's, you know, a step backwards within the decade of the people of African descent. I was very saddened to see that development in the United States. At the same time, there is a growing reparations movement to address historic injustices and inequalities. You know, it started, well, I don't know if it started in the Caribbean, but the Caribbean really had a strong movement that was building for some time, along with scholars in the UK and Europe and America. And this movement really seems to be taking you know, on more momentum. And even though governments are not admitting to, you know, past injustices, colonialism, racism, and so on, we have where people and organizations and so on are trying to do something to apologize and rectify situations of racial inequality. And there have been several stories in the Caribbean press of families, elite families that have apologized and for their role in slavery and have in some cases offered money, even though, you know, there's a debate about, you know, the money not being sufficient. You know, this reparations movement is growing and is gaining momentum too across the Americas. So I see that as something positive because I think the United Nations also recognize the importance of reparations and some form of public apology for slavery and colonialism. So these are important developments, but also very concerned about backlash, white supremacy backlash, and what is happening in the United States as refers to affirmative action.
Doreen, en Negras procuramos soñar. ¿Con qué sueñas? What do you dream about, Doreen?
That's a very good question. I do dream about... I dream about the question of land reform and reparations in the Black community is very important. This kind of grabbing of land that traditional Black families used to live on, I think is an issue right across the diaspora, not just Jamaica, but I've seen it the discussion in the United States and in Brazil. So I would love to see a movement to address land reparations among Black populations. I also dream about a world in which we have to be actively involved in dismantling these ideas about white supremacy. And I dream about mounting a campaign that is just as strong and is, you know, committed to showing some of the myths of white supremacy, you know, that the movement and its ideas must be confronted. And I dream about, you know, a more collaborative effort across the Black diaspora, and involving other people as well, not necessarily African descendants, who are dismantling some of these ideas of white supremacy. Very, very important.
Grandes sueños. You are dreaming so big, but it's so important. Thank you so much for being here with me, Doreen. It has been a pleasure and has been a lecture on the Caribbean, on Jamaica, and the African diaspora. So thank you so much for the opportunity of talking to you today.
Thank you, Barbara. Thanks for inviting me.
You're welcome. Gracias a Itza Santos y al personal técnico de Radio Universidad por su apoyo en esta edición de Negras. No olviden sintonizar Negras el próximo viernes a las 3 de la tarde. Feliz viernes a todos.
Cadena Radio Universidad de Puerto Rico y Colectivo ILE presentaron Negras, asumiendo nuestro justo rol como forjadoras de cambio.
Acaba de escuchar el podcast de Negras. Le invitamos a que nos sintonice los viernes a las 3 de la tarde por Radio Universidad de Puerto Rico en el 89.7 FM San Juan y el 88.3 FM Mayagüez. Todo un mundo de música e información.